This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Albany. The time is 9:01. Coming up next on KBOO, on Political Perspectives, host Joe Meyer interviews Raj Patel, award-winning writer, activist, and academic. His latest book, The Value of Nothing, is a New York Times bestseller. At 10 o'clock here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Nora Barrows-Friedman reports on occupied Palestine for the Electronic Intifada. And we'll hear from pro-choice activists who faced off with anti-abortion activists yesterday on the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. At 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter interviews Rob Dietz, co-author of Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. And at 11:30, Robin Ryan speaks with David Delk of Move to Amend, Paul Cienfuegos of Community Rights PDX, and Andrea Tose of Repeace about the third anniversary of the Citizens United ruling, which gave corporations and unions the right to the green light to spend unlimited sums on ads and other political tools.
January 18, 2013. KBOO Navigator Report. Overwhelming support and a record number of donations were received at the close of 2012. Thank you, KBOO donors. 6 months of hard work have resulted in a more knowledgeable board and updated board policies, completing a grant from the Meyer Memorial Trust. A new partnership with mainstreamed media will give reporters with developmental disabilities a voice on the KBOO Evening News. The KBOO Council of Elders will be gathering in March. For more information, contact Lynn Fitch, 503-231-8032, extension 222, or navigator at kboo.org. This has been the weekly Navigator Report. Thank you.
This Wednesday, January 23rd, KBOO will broadcast live from downtown Portland, where the Illihi Lecture Series kicks off its 2013 lecture series, Who Owns You and What You Can Do About It. With award-winning author, activist, and food policy expert Raj Patel speaking on Who Owns Our Food.
In every food riot that has happened, you've seen a demand for food linked to a demand for political change.
That's 7 this Wednesday, January 23rd. For tickets to the talk, go to illihi.org or listen live on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Meyer, and my guest is Raj Patel, food as right activist and author of Value of Nothing and Stuffed and Starved. Mr. Patel is speaking tonight on Who Owns Your Food and What You Can Do About It at the First Congressional Church, 1126 Southwest Park Avenue, downtown Portland at 7 p.m. KBOO will broadcast his lecture live. In this first quarter hour, we talk about the human sense of fairness, what is sacred and what can be sold, and attempt a definition of neoclassical economics. I start right in with my favorite topic.
I wonder if we could start with a historical perspective. Presumably, early man didn't need an economist for everyone to get enough food.
Well, yes. I mean, in fact, our modern food system is pretty new. The global food system, as it looks at the moment, actually is only 140 years old. So we definitely live in a fairly novel time. And the ills of this global food system are ones that are now written on bodies across the world. We now are in a time where there are certainly over 1.5 billion people who are overweight, and nearly a billion people who are malnourished. So this novel food system, as I say, about 130, 140 years old in its current incarnation, and it's not doing terribly well.
Getting back to kind of the long-term historical perspective, or even looking to the primate world for examples, do humans, though, have an innate sense of fairness?
That's right, and I think, you know, it takes a lot for that innate sense of fairness to be sort of mutated into the kind of dog-eat-dog world that we're in at the moment. But it is important for us to remember that when people try to justify the free market system, they say that basically human beings are greedy, and that is the key motivation that keeps human beings alive. And that's just not true. You know, if you look at human beings, or if you look at our primate cousins, you don't see sort of the one primate who decides to go it alone and to be a sort of pure selfish individual, because normally in primate societies, the individual who does that doesn't live very long. We are selfish, but we are also hardwired to cooperate and to be, to some extent altruistic, and to have a built-in sense of fairness, because that's what allows living collectively to work well. So we are evolutionarily well adapted to have a sense of fairness, as well, of course, as a sense of sort of self-preservation. I mean, I'm no sort of dripping hippie thinking that we're pure creatures of light, but it's certainly true, and it can't be stated enough, that we are not pure, selfish, greedy individuals. I mean, even the most greedy individuals in society today, who are, according to some tests, graduate students in economics are among the most selfish people in the world, but even they have a sense of fairness and are not purely these rational, calculating individuals. The closest we come to pure, greedy, calculating individuals with no sense of fairness are corporations. And the corporations are chartered and designed to be utility-maximizing, profit-maximizing entities. But for normal human people, we do have this deep sense of fairness that's hard to stamp out.
Right, and I think kind of the history of what is allowed to be bought, what's allowed to be brought onto the marketplace, brings about a moral sense. You mentioned in your book that it would be repugnant to sell organs. Can you say something about the history of what we're allowed to sell?
This country was founded on slavery. It was founded on the idea that it was okay to buy and sell people. And thankfully, we've moved beyond thinking that that is okay. We balk at the idea of being able to buy and sell organs, but we do traffic in people's labor. And we, I have this example in The Value of Nothing of a hamburger, and where a dollar hamburger seems like a bargain, but pretty much everyone has scratched their heads and wondered, how is it that this only costs a dollar? There's a meat, there's what passes for meat, and there's what looks like a bun, and all of this made just for me, a dollar, really? How does that happen? Well, it happens because we are able to squeeze work from workers who are paid pitifully little. I mean, if you look at the worst paying jobs in America, most of them are in the food system, whether they're in food service work, where the minimum wage is still $2.13 an hour, all the way through to the fields if there are tomatoes in your burgers, then in southern Florida, there are workers, some of whom are working in conditions of modern-day slavery. So even though we've outlawed slavery and outlawed those kinds of inhumane transactions, there are still people who are chained to the back of trucks, who are forced to buy goods and services from the company store. And there are examples of people having to pay $5 for a shower to hose off at the end of the day after picking tomatoes laced with pesticides. And some people find it's cheaper to wash your hands in bleach than it is to pay $5 for a shower from the company store. So the point of that is just to show that while we do make moral choices about what it is that we buy and sell in markets, and we don't believe in buying and selling people, there are conditions associated with slavery that still obtain and are still there with us today, hidden in some of the most cheapest things that we put into our mouths. If we were to include the full environmental and social costs, a dollar burger shouldn't cost a dollar. Researchers in India suggested that if you just look at the environmental footprint, every dollar burger should cost nearer $200. Now, this isn't to say, of course, that we should be paying $200 for every burger, but this should be saying that what we need to be doing is including the full environmental costs into the way we eat today, and also to raise wages so that everyone can afford to pay the full costs of what it is that they eat and the way we consume.
Well, this idea of a cheap hamburger happens within this economic system in your value of nothing. You talk a little bit about economic theory. Can you just give us what we need to know about classical economics and then neoclassical economics?
Adam Smith was actually a very subtle thinker, and he understood that the laws of supply and demand were able to help us make huge advances in society. But he was also very, very worried about the concentration of power that things like corporations accumulated under this new economic system. And he, along with the other sort of founders of economics, were very concerned about power and about unearned wealth. And modern economic theory tosses all of that out of the window and suggests that actually markets are the best way of organizing not just production, but organizing society as well. So you have modern economics even applying itself to theories around marriage, for example, in which some people argue that the way to that we can apply price theory to explain why rich men are often seen with beautiful women, and that actually the best thing to do for less beautiful women is to encourage bigamy, so that that way slightly less supermodel looking women will be able to get for themselves a rich husband. And so this is the kind of reductio ad absurdum. This is the kind of bonkers end game of modern economic theory. But there are some people who published that and, in fact, won a Nobel Prize for it, too.
So classical economic theory is basically, sure, free markets, but with regulation, and the neoclassical is just throw away the regulations.
Well, I think, in a nutshell, that's certainly one way of reading it. I mean, the original founders, when the modern economy was just blossoming, there were a lot of people thinking very critically about it, and it seems like most critical thinking now has been thrown out the window.
I see. Well, Adam Smith in his Wealth of Nations is quoted, he's got the famous invisible hand quote. How does that fit in?
Well, I mean, the idea of an invisible hand is through the individual actions of people looking out for their best interest within sort of constrained circumstances, that it seems as if a magic machine of production has been organized by an invisible hand. What's interesting there is it's possible for incredibly intricate systems to be organized without the hand of big government or without the hand of corporations, frankly. And I think that what's interesting about this idea of the invisible hand is that it points to the complexity of human organization that can emerge from society. One of the things that we often forget about is that people are really good at organizing economic systems together. In fact, when we think about the commons, for instance, the commons is a word that people associate with tragedy. When you think about the tragedy of the commons, you think about how people are so self-interested that they've destroyed the resources on which they depend. You think of the Dust Bowl, or you think of various kinds of environmental catastrophe where people have just whittled away at the resources that we all share together, and because nobody owns them, we have eroded them away. And what I like about the idea of the commons is that it's a case of sort of human organization actually emerging. If you look at the history of the commons, people have actually been really good at managing resources together, and we have just sort of the remains of that idea in our language today. Like when the word stinting, for example, when you think of someone who is unstinting, you think of someone who doesn't save. But stinting used to be the word for when in a commons area that lots of people manage together, you would not consume something this year because you needed it next year. And there's lots of examples in history and, in fact, alive and well today where people are managing resources collectively without putting them into a market relationship. So people are negotiating and having democratic conversations about how to manage resources like forests or fisheries without big government or big corporations coming into the picture. And I think that idea of social organization emerging through a series of long-term human interactions is a really interesting way of thinking about the invisible hand, but without the market. And so, I mean, I think Adam Smith was interested in social organization, and I think that there are we should take that curiosity about social organization and look at other forms to see how we can move beyond the markets that we find ourselves trapped by today.
So the invisible hand may apply equally well to cash markets as to early man sharing food.
Absolutely.
I was interested to read about The Great Transformation, Carl Polanyi's book.
Carl Polanyi noticed that he's a sort of an unsung hero in social theory. I mean, the sort of person you come across in graduate school and you wonder how you ever managed without him. But he's a thinker who was writing in the middle of the Second World War. And what he was looking at is how markets emerge, and in particular how markets in Britain emerged at the beginning of the 18th century. And he was curious because what he saw was that there was a myth of the self-regulating market, he said, and there were various business people and commercial types who were arguing that what Britain needed in the 18th century was for markets to be totally unregulated, and the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. And what emerged instead was the whittling away of society. And so when markets failed, society ultimately had to catch the falling market. So workers were pushed to the brink of starvation, but they organized, and there was a counter movement against the predations of this sort of free market thinking. And so society kind of corrected itself. That's what Carl Polanyi was saying, that there was an economic push and then a kind of social push back. That double movement is something that you can see in society today. When he was writing in the Second World War, what he was seeing was that fascism was, in some ways, a response to the sort of craziness of the free market in the 1920s and early 1930s and the depression that followed. And what I like about this idea of the double movement, of society swinging from a sort of free market antics all the way back into a more socially embedded market, is that there's nothing necessary about when the economy gets re-embedded in society, when the economy becomes gets caught again by society after its free market excesses. That process of catching society, it doesn't have to be a positive thing. Fascism is not a positive way of catching, of moving away from a free market. But it's unfortunately, in today's day and age, there are quite a few examples where in the wake of the recession, you've seen a rise of the far right as a response to the excesses of the free market. I mean, right in here in the United States, we've seen many hate groups emerge in the wake of the financial crisis. In Greece, for example, the far right, the fascists, are alive and well and winning votes. So what Carl Polanyi says about how when markets fail, society tries to re-embed the market in it, and we should watch that process, but we should also make sure that when society does re-embed the market, the way we do it is a progressive way rather than a reactionary way, because that danger is always there.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Meyer, and my guest is Raj Patel, food as right activist and author of Value of Nothing and Stuffed and Starved. Mr. Patel is speaking tonight on Who Owns Your Food and What You Can Do About It at the First Congregational Church, 1126 Southwest Park Avenue, downtown Portland, at 7 p.m. KBOO will broadcast his lecture live. Raj just summarized political economist Carl Polanyi's cultural approach to economics, which emphasized the way economies are embedded in society. Polanyi's 1944 book, The Great Transformation, describes how the enclosure of common lands in 17th and 18th century England caused mass migration to the cities, provided cheap labor for industry, and gave birth to the now omnipotent and omnipresent market economy. In this second quarter, Raj Patel and I turn from general economics to the supply and demand of food, touching on biofuel and genetically modified crops.
Well, how do we know our food system is broken today?
Well, we know it's broken today by looking at our waistlines. I mean, right here in the United States, 4 out of 10 Americans have a normal body weight, and the rest of us are either overweight or obese. Now, that in and of itself isn't a problem, but it's it's associated with a range of other problems that are pretty bad. I mean, one in three kids born in the year 2000 will develop type 2 diabetes. One in two kids of color will develop type 2 diabetes. And also, we're living in a country where 50 million people are food insecure. And that's just in the United States. But globally, there are 1.5 billion people who are overweight and 850 million people who don't have enough to eat just to be able to function during a day. So that to me says that we're living in a food system where the priorities are deeply wrong. And this happens at the time where we're producing more calories per person than ever before in human history. So it's not as if we're short of food on Earth today. There's more than enough food to feed everyone. The reason that people go hungry today is because we distribute food through the market. And when you distribute food through the market, you have two pretty simple rules. If you have money, then you get to eat. If you don't have money, you starve. And then, of course, there's another wrinkle here, because historically, if you were overweight, you were rich, and if you were thin, you were poor. But these days, if you're overweight, particularly in a developed country, it's usually because you're at the lower end of the income spectrum. And that's because if you are poor, the chances are you don't have a whole lot of time, you don't have a whole lot of access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And if you're running from one place to another and you're trying to pick up the kids and you're trying to make enough money to be able to keep your health insurance, then it's not surprising that the only place you get to eat a meal is off your lap. And if that's the case, then the kinds of food you find yourself eating are usually cheap and highly processed. And those kinds of foods lead to, again, to some pretty bad health outcomes. So that's how we know our food system is broken.
Can we trace the origin of that? When did the kind of modern broken food system start?
The global market in food was a product of colonialism. So when you start having these international markets is when you have the rise both of an increased level of production of food. So by the end of the 19th century, India is producing more food than it has ever before in its history. So this modern global food system is very good at setting the incentives for sort of massive production of commodity crops. But it's also very bad at distributing the fruits of that bounty, because at the same time as India was this sort of economic powerhouse, it was also a country that was experiencing famines at a far greater extent than it ever had in its history. I mean, there's a statistic that the historian Mike Davis digs up about India's history, which is that in the 2,000 years before the British arrived in India, India had a famine once every 120 years. So, if you go back in a time machine and you see a famine, you'd have to wait more than a century for the next famine to happen. But after the British came and after they imposed these global markets in food, what you have is a situation where there's a famine once every 4 years. So once, with the regularity of an election cycle.
Obama talked a lot about biofuel 4 years ago. Does that play into this at all?
If you look at the reasons for the global food crisis in 2008, and by that I mean not just sort of the background level of incredible hunger, but the huge spike in the number of people who were going hungry, which happened in 2008 and 2009. The reason the prices went up was because we were diverting crops away from food to turn them into biofuel, to be able to turn corn into ethanol so that we can add it to our gas tank. And I think that there's something, both economically just wrong about that, that the needs of people who drive cars in rich countries gets to trump the needs of people going hungry in poor countries. But it's also just sort of preposterous that at a time of hunger we would grow food not in order to eat it, but to set it on fire. But the reason that biofuels get to affect prices around the world is because there's also a global trade system that links our fields to the bowls of people in Africa or in India. And I think, yes, biofuels are a problem, but I think the deeper problem is the international economic architecture that stitches us together and binds us in ways that transmit shocks very, very easily. So in 2010, for example, when there were fires in Russia, and Russia banned grain exports as a result, there were food protests in Mozambique because the price of wheat had gone up and Russia wasn't supplying them to the global market. Now, you could ask a number of questions about that story. You could say, well, why does Mozambique want wheat in the first place? It's not a native crop, but it's because of colonialism that a demand for bread has been developed in Mozambique. And then you know, you could ask, well, why, you know, what's the global trade system doing in Mozambique anyway, when clearly there's not much evidence that Mozambique agriculture benefits from having global trade. And so there are a number of questions one can and should ask about, you know, these the stories around why the food price spikes exist. Biofuel is certainly part of it. Climate change is certainly part of it. Speculation by banks is certainly part of it. But I think, you know, underneath it all, that there is this sort of big economic architecture issue that I think we need to pay attention to as well.
So biofuels aren't inherently bad. It's just a matter of managing things and setting our priorities straight.
I think that industrially produced biofuels are usually going to displace food production. Okay. I mean, I haven't seen an example where massive-scale biofuels doesn't kick people off land, you know, who might otherwise be farming it for food. But I do think that there are examples of sustainable biofuels use which are to be commended. But I think that behind biofuels is also another question, which is, why are we still addicted to the internal combustion engine? What is it about the internal combustion engine that's so terrific? Can we not imagine other ways of powering things? Can we not imagine other mechanisms for, you know, for making sure that our needs for transport are met? And so, I do think biofuels have a place, but it's a far smaller place in our future energy economy than most, you know, most governments seem to think at the moment.
Well, I surely agree with you there, Raj. I can just, every time I turn on my car, I can't believe there's all these explosions going on. kind of the same question with regard to ownership of genes or genetically modified organisms. What kind of role do they play?
At the moment, the global market in genetically modified crops is basically run by the pesticide companies, because most crops are either engineered to exude pesticide from their, you know, from the body of the plant, or to withstand a particular kind of broad spectrum herbicide, so that farmers can spray and forget and not have to worry about weeding. Now, we're already seeing the sort of the end of those kinds of benefits. We've seen the rise of super weeds here in the United States that are resistant to this hormone-based herbicide. And Dow Chemical are now applying for a patent to be able to genetically modify plants to resist a different kind of pesticide, a pesticide called 2,4-D. Not many people know what 2,4-D is, but its most famous appearance is as a component of Agent Orange. So, you know, we're now being told that that we're going to have an applications, and we'll soon be able to buy, maybe, plants that are resistant to Agent Orange. So we'll be spraying Agent Orange, but there'll be one plant that resists it, and that is progress in the world of genetically modified crops. Now, it seems to me that there's a very deep problem when we have to resort to genetically modifying our crops to resist one of the most dangerous herbicides yet invented. But there is an honest question here, which is, can genetically modified crops be part of a future sustainable agriculture? And I'm very much in favor of science. I think what we need is investment in science to be able to figure out questions about how to grow crops sustainably in the future. But it seems to me that monoculture is, if we're interested in a system of agriculture that is climate change ready, that is, you know, going to be robust in terms of the freak storms and floods that the president referred to in his inauguration speech. If we're interested in a world of agriculture that's robust in terms of shocks that we don't know are coming, so we don't know when the rains are going to be exceedingly heavy, we don't know what the profile of disease and the pest is going to affect our crop, then what you want is not a single crop, but a polyculture. You want a range of different crops working together to be able to create a viable system that's much more resilient than a monoculture is. And the research that I'm seeing from genetically modified crops just perpetuates sort of monoculture and the idea that a single crop or a single trait is going to be able to get us through hard times ahead. And I think when we look at the data, and luckily, you know, being in favor of science is a good thing, because you actually get to point to data where we have monocultures comparing very unfavorably with resilient ecosystems, or ecosystemic farming, agroecological farming. You know, for example, when Hurricane Mitch tore through the Caribbean, the farms that were agroecological were up and running 60 days before farms that were monocultures, just because they were, you know, they had a lot of systemic sort of buffers built into the way that farming was happening, so that they could respond to a shock like a hurricane and still be up and running much, much faster than their monoculture counterparts. So that's, I would support science and research in agriculture. I particularly support science and research in agriculture in agroecological farming rather than in the kind of the world of genetic engineering where it seems that billions of dollars have been poured and not much has come out as a result. So I don't see GM crops as an answer to much of anything other than the profit needs of pesticide companies. And I think that while these companies will tout the benefits of their particular seeds, we've got increasing data to suggest that for farmers, particularly in the global south, the kind of agriculture that's needed is science-driven agroecological farming that has yields far superior to conventional agriculture.
Are there market solutions to food distribution problems we're facing today?
In what sense?
Can the invisible hand feed everyone on Earth?
Well, the invisible hand is only interested in feeding people who have visible cash. I mean, again, it seems pretty straightforward to me that if you don't have money, the invisible hand is just basically going to give you the finger. I don't see ways in which a proper market economy is going to pay attention to people who are too poor to participate in that market economy. So I think that the kinds of ways that we see working to feed people are precisely those kinds of interventions that aren't about providing services to the highest bidder, but are instead about turning food into a human right, which it is. I mean, insofar as human rights exist and countries have signed up to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the right to food is right in there as a human right. The trouble is that there is a country that refuses to recognize the right to food, and we live in it. The United States is the only country at a recent vote that did not agree that there was such a thing as the human right to food. Every other country does. And I think it's important for us to feel shame that we are not that we're alone in not recognizing the human right to food.
Is selling food then as repugnant as selling as a kidney or an eye?
No. I mean, I think that we need a world where exchange is celebrated, and I'm a big fan of consenting trade between people. I think that that's a very good thing. The world in which we live, though, is moving inexorably away from that because capitalism is kind of the anti-market. I mean, I think that the kind of market where two uncoerced individuals exchange goods and services is terrific. But in a world where markets are dominated by a few powerful corporations and a few powerful governments, that doesn't seem, that's kind of the anti-market. We have our choices constrained. We have costs dumped on us by these unscrupulous actors who don't have to pay the full price of what it is that they're doing. So I would much rather see exchange on terms set by democracy rather than by sort of a concentrated capital, a government run by plutocrats, basically. So I do think that exchange is tremendously important. In fact, I'm following the lead here of an international peasant movement called La Via Campesina. And there are over 200 million farmers and farm workers and landless people who are fighting for precisely this right to be able to exchange freely and exchange on terms that they set. So I don't think that buying and selling food is a bad thing. I think that if that's the only way in which people get to eat, then obviously people will starve because not everyone has money. But luckily, I think that there is a place for markets, and there's a place really for the kind of flat, unhierarchical market in which both parties are equally powerful. And that kind of market, I think, needs to be celebrated. The bad side is that particularly the way that corporations and finance capital in particular has concentrated market power today. We live in a world that's the opposite of free exchange.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Meyer, and my guest is Raj Patel, food as right activist and author of Value of Nothing and Stuffed and Starved. Mr. Patel is speaking tonight on Who Owns Your Food and What You Can Do About It at the First Congressional Church, 1126 Southwest Park Avenue, downtown Portland at 7 p.m. KBOO will broadcast his lecture live. Raj just explained that free markets may be good at growing a lot of food, but are not good at getting food to poor, hungry people. He recounted that Long-term historically, India would experience a famine once every 120 years, and after the British brought in global markets, India experienced a famine once every 4 years. What? This halftime show was brought to you by KBOO members. Thank you, members. In the third quarter, Raj Patel and I talk about the commons, food rebellions, and size limits on a New York soda. We start with a definition of food sovereignty.
Food sovereignty is about bringing democracy to our food system. The way that most of our decisions in the food system have been taken to date have been the opposite of democratic. They've been dumped on us by, again, you know, the choices we make in a supermarket. The choice to go to a supermarket is actually not usually a choice. We do it of necessity and out of what we call convenience, but you know, things become convenient because we have so little time that we need to do or get our provisions for daily life in something that's basically a poorly lit warehouse. So what food sovereignty is about bringing, for the first time often, a democratic conversation to the way we feed ourselves and our community and our world today. And that's different from making sure that there's enough food. And food sovereignty isn't about just everyone just growing food for themselves in their own backyard. Food sovereignty is about the democratic conversation through which we decide that how food is distributed.
Are there some examples you can point to of that?
If you think of food policy councils, for example, food policy councils in North America, there are about 200 of them, where local businesses and local government and activists get together to figure out how to make sure that everyone in the city gets to eat and gets to eat well. What's happening here is not that food is directly being provided, and that's a sort of step away. But what's happening here is that the venues for exchange are being created in communities through these discussions. And I think that's an example of food sovereignty at work, where at a food policy council, people will get together and figure out how it is collectively and collaboratively that they will be able to make food available to people who need it.
Well, in this country, anytime you talk about reining in the free market, people are talking about you're stepping on my liberties.
In capitalism, if you are rich, you're as free as you like. But if the only mechanism that you have to be able to access goods and services is through the free market, and if you are poor, then your freedom is substantially constrained. Now, for instance, when you think about the food system, people are looking at Mayor Bloomberg's limit on soda portions as an example of the nanny state, and it's an interference with capitalism and interference with freedom. It's certainly interference with capitalism, but actually it's helping liberty, because if I'm going to be a parent who takes responsibility for my children, then I want the freedom to be able to take responsibility. And I can't take responsibility for my kids when for every dollar that's spent promoting food that's good for you, $500 is spent promoting junk food. And that wherever my kid goes, that they will see junk food advertising thrown at them. If I'm trying to be a responsible parent, but corporations are doing the very best that they can to try and outspend me and outparent my kid. And that doesn't seem to be liberty in any meaningful way for me. So in order for my liberty to be given back to me, corporations need their liberties taken away, and I'm okay with that.
If there are some commons, there's the worry that one person will go in there and take everything. What prevents people from doing that?
People who are greedy in a social system, well, there are various ways in which either social stigma is attached to them so that they don't want to be seen to be the greedy person, or there are sanctions for people who take more than their fair share. And so every common system also has a mechanism for altruistic punishment if it comes to that. Usually there are other ways in which people who try to take more than their fair share can be persuaded not to through a range of sort of social sanctions within the community.
It's something that we do naturally somehow.
Well, that's it. I mean, altruistic punishment is one of the things that human beings and primates do basically out of the womb. I mean, that's one of the things that we are hardwired to do.
Okay, the last part of our show is called What Can We Do About It? And I wonder if you could start with sort of a brief history of food riots, food rebellions.
When people heard in 2008 about food riots and rebellions, what you may have heard was that there were people screaming in the streets, and what you saw was people, the remains of burning tires, and usually a sort of breathless journalist telling you that there were crazed mobs running thither and yon, wanting to be able to find enough food to eat. But usually when you have a food rebellion, it's not a riot, it's not a sort of mad, sort of mindless mob. But there's usually and invariably politics involved. So people taking to the streets do so when they've exhausted every other possible opportunity. And when they take to the streets, it's not a kind of just a crazed yelling. But actually what's happening is a very a deep and reasoned approach to why it is that the food system needs to change, why the political system needs to change. And those conversations are ones that we've had here in this country. I mean, in 1917, in the United States, there were a number of food riots, or food rebellions, I think is the better term, in New York and in Baltimore and Chicago and in Boston. And those protests were led by women because the women couldn't vote at that time. So the only option they had to make policymakers listen was to take to the streets. And they took to the streets demanding both a reduction in the price of food, but also the right to vote. And in fact, the right to vote in the United States was won by women taking to the streets, sparked by food protests and high food prices, but driven also by a range of political concerns. And that's a healthy way of understanding what's happening in the Middle East, where the Arab Spring was kicked off by people taking to the streets, sparked by high wheat prices, but then driven forward by a range of concerns around inequality and injustice. And I think, you know, on the cards, as food prices spike through this year and for the foreseeable future, a range of people, a range of protests and rebellions happening, driven by the material needs to feed one's family, but also then by the political need to be able to have a voice in one's future.
Is it simply true that we have to wait for things to get bad enough before we can change them?
I don't think so. I mean, first of all, it's important for us to recognize things are bad already. I mean, what's good about having nearly a billion people who are starving and nearly 2 billion people overweight and, you know, one in three kids in the U.S. Facing type 2 diabetes? Things are pretty lousy. But I don't like this, what some friends of mine have called catastrophism, the sort of philosophy of thinking about the world where you just have to wait for things to hit bottom before we can begin our 12-step procedure to work our way back to sobriety. I think that model of social change, I mean, it may work in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it doesn't work in a society. We can and we should be able to organize for change right now because things are really bad right now. And I think that the good news is that there are a lot of people already organizing for change in the food system and for change in the economy more broadly.
Commons is not a word you hear often, except maybe creative commons on the internet, an open source movement. Is that related to what you're doing?
It is. Well, I mean, insofar as the commons on the internet is a way of people sharing and managing resources together in common, I think there is a natural affinity. But the difference is that when you release something as Creative Commons on the internet, it can be copied many times and it's still essentially intact. Whereas when we're thinking about resource commons that are real physical tangible resources, those can't be copied again and again. And so we do need the more sustained and engaged conversations to be able to work together to share these resources that are limited in a way that the Creative Commons isn't. But insofar as there's a shared philosophy that we can manage our resources together and that sharing and liberating the process of governing these resources away from big corporations and from big government, I think that there is a natural affinity there.
Right. Is our current economic theory only wrong because the world is finite?
I think that's a fairly big criticism, what with the world being finite and economic theory and assuming that it isn't. So that's a fairly big problem right there. But I think also that the problem is that the idea that we are selfish and greedy individuals has made its way to the heart of much of the way we organize the world politically and economically. And the fact is that we're not these people. We are much better. And we're capable of organizing ourselves in much more sustainable systems than than large corporations can do for us. And so I think that that's also a deep problem with the way that at the heart of current economic theory.
Right. Well, Rod, you seem pretty optimistic about things. Can you share some more good news?
Well, I mean, I'm currently working on a documentary with the director Steve James, who did a film called Hoop Dreams, and more recently The Interrupters. So we're looking actually at solutions around the world where we're seeing some incredible stories of resilience and hope. So everything from a story in Malawi, and I'll be telling talking about this explicitly at the talk, a story in Malawi where there are agroecological farm mechanisms that are not only creating more food than industrial agriculture. So this agroecological system is producing 15% more than a system that uses fertilizer and pesticides and what have you. So there's more food around, plus women and men are, there's more equality as a result of this food system because of some of the social mechanisms around the food system. And this food system is robust in terms of climate change. So while northern Malawi, where this food system is doing very well, southern Malawi is doing pretty badly because they've stuck to this industrial food system and they're not doing as well as they might. So there are real-world examples of agroecology bringing substantial benefits to people who are involved in it. And you know, I think that kind of organizing in Malawi has its sort of corollary in India, for example. There are farmers' movements who are pushing back against Monsanto, forcing the government in India to sue Monsanto over Monsanto's theft of genetically germplasm. There, they stole the DNA of an eggplant that was indigenous to India without asking the Indian government. So, you know, the governments are being forced into doing the right thing by citizens' movements in India. And we're covering some of those stories as well. I'm not sort of looking at the world through rose-tinted glasses. I mean, I think we need pessimism of the intellect as well as optimism of the will. I think, you know, we need to be fairly clear-eyed about how much power is in the hands of banks and of large corporations and how much our government is in hock to those corporations. But on the other hand, you are seeing people fighting from the grassroots up, and that's something I think we can derive a great deal of inspiration from.
No doubt. Any examples in the U.S. of A of people reclaiming the commons?
Well, I mean, I've been really excited to see some of the stuff that's happening in Detroit because some of the most amazing urban farming is happening there on land that have been rendered derelict by the decline of the automobile industry. And so when Detroit downsized from being a city of 2 million people to a city of 900,000, a lot of vacant lots sort of sprouted up, as it were. And on that land, some of the most incredible urban farming has been happening. And I've been talking to people there who grow food and often say, have signs saying, help yourself. They've found that the people who come and help themselves are the people who are not greedy, but who actually just need it to feed their families. And so there's been a sort of good balance struck between the gardening that happens for domestic consumption, the gardening that happens for community sharing. And I think Detroit is a really interesting example of a place where, because supermarkets haven't been terribly interested in Detroit, and instead people have been making do with a range of other solutions, and some of those solutions, like commoning around food and farming, have been incredibly inspirational.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Meyer, and my guest is Raj Patel, food as right activist and author of Value of Nothing and Stuffed and Starved. Mr. Patel is speaking tonight on Who Owns Your Food and What You Can Do About It at the First Congregational Church, 1126 Southwest Park Avenue, downtown Portland at 7 p.m. KBOO will broadcast his lecture live. Summarizing the third quarter, Raj Patel told us how food rebellions have two motivations: the immediate need to feed your family and the need for a political voice in shaping food policy. The food sovereignty movement shares the philosophy of the free, as in freedom, software movement, and smart traditional farming is proving to be more resilient and productive than industrial monocrops. In this final quarter, we talk about the right to have rights and free Cascadia.
In The Value of Nothing, you speak for a while about the right to have rights, and money is a way to have rights. Can you talk more about that?
Here's a thought experiment. It comes from an Oxford philosopher whose name is Jerry Cohen. And what he suggested was, if you think that money is about freedom and about liberty, here's a thought experiment. Imagine that we live in a world that isn't about, that doesn't have money in it, but instead has lots of little paper tickets. And on these tickets are rights. You know, you have the right to free speech. You have the right to health care. You have the right to go on holiday. You have the right to go visit your mum. And on, you know, these tickets are distributed at random. And some people will have lots of these tickets, and some of these people will have one or two. And in this world, if you have a bunch of tickets, you don't have to do the things that are on these tickets, but you can, because you have a ticket that gives you the right. And if you try to do something for which you do not have a ticket, then that's when the police will come in and stop you. So what Jerry Cohen says is, look, that world is just like this world, except in this world, instead of tickets, what we have is money. So if you are poor, if you have just one or two dollar bills, the number of freedoms that you have is pretty limited. And if you try to exercise a freedom that you don't have enough money for, the police will come and stop you. Whereas if you have lots of money, then you have a lot of rights. And what we need to be pushing for is actually the ability to be able to have rights, the ability for everyone to be able to have these rights in common. Because it's one thing for rights to be sort of written on declarations, but in the real world, what matters is being able to actualize those rights. And the right to have rights is a way of talking about the possibility of being able to actualize the freedoms that we allegedly have.
I'm not sure I get that. Is there a way to measure that or see how that may be different among different countries?
Well, I mean, if one thinks of healthcare and healthcare outcomes, for example, I mean, just think of the right to food. I mean, in the United States, the right to food is scorned here, and that's one of the reasons why we have 50 million people who are food insecure in the United States, whereas countries where the right to food is taken more seriously, the level of, you know, the number of citizens who are food insecure is much lower. So you don't have to go very far outside the United States. I mean, if you go to Canada, for instance, per capita, the number of people who are hungry is way less than it is here. I believe it's about half. So, you know, as a proportion of the population, the number of people who are going hungry in Canada is far, far lower, because their right to food is actualized by the government.
Again, another argument may be saying, can we stay in the current system? I think it's a libertarian idea, negative income tax. Everyone in the country gets $1,000 a month. They can buy food and medical care. Does that keep the current market-based system alive and still feed everyone?
I'm conflicted about that. I mean, I certainly think that a basic income grant has a place. I mean, there are a lot of people who are arguing about it. And one of the ways that the basic income grant makes sense to me is because of what it does to value women's unpaid work. And I think that argument is actually a very, very good idea. On the other hand, merely having a basic income grant but without addressing the fundamental sort of structural inequalities means that just a simple basic income grant keeps the status quo as it is. So, you know, with a basic income grant, it's not like Bill Gates suddenly stops being a billionaire. It just means that he has less money coming in than he's used to. But if you don't address the inequalities about who owns the resources in a society, then the people who have managed to concentrate lots of resources so far will lead a merry dance, even if there is this basic kind of a basic income grant of some kind. So I think there is a way in which a basic income grant does free up people to be able to be recognized for the work that they're already doing around community work, for instance, and caring for elders and what have you. On the other hand, I think that if we don't address some of these structural issues in the way the economy works today, then a simple basic income grant can be a prescription to carry on the status quo.
People like to talk about free Cascadia here in Portland. Does food revolution look like geography on watersheds?
One of the ways in which we can think about building commons is by moving to think of different units of geography. And one of the ways in which our natural world is bounded, like food sheds and watersheds, look very different from the way that you know, states are drawn on a map. And the geography of these kinds of commons is going to look very different. And we can imagine them sort of overlapping, and we can imagine different different issue areas needing different levels of government. And if this sounds awful and complicated, and you imagine it could never possibly work, actually there is an example where these kinds of different levels of democracy and different levels of communities getting together has been working for a while, and that's the Balkans. Now, people think of the Balkans as a place sort of riven by conflict and disaster, but in fact, that's not what the commons is about. In fact, and the Balkans have, for a very long time, been a place of where different levels of democracy and concern interact with each other. And so while some people say, well, the Balkans is an advertisement of what happens when you put states in places where they don't belong, in fact, the system that predates the states in the Balkans, or where states mattered less, was a system with lots of overlapping kinds of democracy.
Does the return of the commons require some kind of new socialization? If we're socialized to be greedy and the commons exist, does that fail?
Yes, that's a great question, Joel. I mean, I think the way that we're brought up at the moment, where you're not allowed to talk about politics and religion at the dinner table, is not the kind of is not a great way to be socialized for the commons, because the commons is about talking at the dinner table about the most important things. If you're involved in a project of commoning, then you have to talk about awkward things like the distribution of resources, of scarce resources, and how it is that these things should be divided fairly. And because we're in a political culture where we're encouraged more than anything else just to shout at each other, Frank Zappa's line that politics is the entertainment branch of industry, I think is a very good line. I think that's all politics is just sort of high-stakes entertainment. Then we don't, we're not well socialized to deal in a commons with being, reasonable individuals capable of not always getting our way, but always feeling like we're being treated fairly. And so I do think that we do, we need sort of trainer wheels for learning to be democratic. And again, there are examples where that's possible. I mean, food policy councils is an example I keep returning to, because food policy councils seem to me to be examples of places where you can respectfully disagree and where diverse opinions can be brought to the table, and yet good ideas usually win out. I think that we do need a cultural shift in being able to get along with people we disagree with passionately, figuring out ways of respectful, political discourse. But I think that that's a project that everyone can embrace, because it means that everything gets better.
It does sound like there's a lot of great news. How can people participate?
Well, I mean, I think figuring out, joining a food policy council, and if people want to learn more about that, the Community Food Security Alliance is online, just search for food policy councils. You'll get a wealth of information there. But I think the thing about commons is that they can be set up around pretty much any resource or any idea, any set of resources that people get passionate about. We're seeing commons spring up around things like Occupy Sandy. The Occupy movement itself was an attempt to build the infrastructure for that. And I think in the recovery efforts for Hurricane Sandy, Occupy Sandy is a fantastic example of people getting together and reimagining, not just sort of building, as Rebecca Solnit says, a paradise in hell, but also thinking about how communities can govern themselves in the future. And I think that those kinds of examples are ready to be found out about and emulated.
Well, anything I missed, Raj?
No, I mean, I think, well, there is one thing which is just about food sovereignty. I just want to get back to that just for a second, because there isn't a short definition of food sovereignty, but one of the slogans around food sovereignty is this, that food sovereignty is about an end to all forms of violence against women. And the reason I want to mention that is because, particularly in India, when people have been following the horrific story around rape there, this idea of food sovereignty and violence to women seems so far apart. But actually, if we're thinking about the lived experiences every day of people fighting for a better world, gender violence is a very real concern. When you tackle gender violence, and not just the physical violence, which of course is horrific and far too widespread, but also the structural violence of being, unable to send your daughter to school because she's needed at home, or being unable to sell the fruits of your market garden in the local market because the European Union or the United States is dumping crops at below the cost of production there. There are structural forces that also need to be tackled if we're going to have a proper democracy and a proper democratic conversation. I think one of the things about commoning is, particularly when it comes to food, but in general, is a recognition that if we're going to have proper commons, we need equality. And I think that that's one of the ideas that is, it seemed very abstract when I was writing The Value of Nothing, to talk about one of these slogans from La Via Campesina, who had invented this idea of food sovereignty, about food sovereignty is about an end to all forms of violence against women. But unfortunately, recent events have shown that actually, if we're serious about genuine democracy and genuine democratic conversation and a better economy, then we need very urgently to address the inequalities that are in the home but are throughout the economy before we can have a proper democracy in the first place.
Well, it seems like an elegant definition to me, the end to all forms of violence against women. Raj Patel, thanks so much for talking to KBOO.
No, not at all. Thanks so much for a really generous conversation.
You've been listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Meyer, and my guest was Raj Patel, food as right activist. Mr. Patel is speaking tonight on who owns your food and what you can do about it at the First Congregational Church, 1126 Southwest Park Avenue, downtown Portland, at 7 p.m., and KBOO will broadcast this lecture live. This edition of Political Perspectives was recorded and produced at the studios of KBOO Portland and made possible by KBOO members. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Joe Meyer. And Sisyphus is happy!
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 10:01. Coming up next is Air Cascadia with your host, Chris Andre.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of the Q Center Winter Gala, Fire and Ice. Fire and Ice will be held at Castaway Portland, 1900 Northwest 18th Avenue, on Saturday, January 26th. The VIP party begins at 6 p.m. and general admission is at 7. Entertainment includes a performance by two-time Grammy Award winner Matt Albert and much more. Information about the Q Center Winter Gala can be found at kboo.fm/2013fireandice.
Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, January 23rd, 2013.